The hymn we've just sung is one that very often features at remembrance ceremonies. It will have been sung on Friday, November the 11th, Armistice Day itself. And by many more today, Remembrance Sunday, the day to remember the sacrifices made in war, as we've been doing. It's a hymn that has grown national and military connections over the years, though actually that wasn't what Isaac Watts had in mind when he published the hymn first in 1719. Our God, our help in ages past. One unusual place it was sung was at the conference of Prime Minister Winston Churchill, whose voice we've heard this morning, and US President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. A great president. It's August 1941, should be a picture on the screen, at the height of the Second World War. And they're meeting to discuss the Atlantic Charter, the special relationship as we call it now. The picture shows the service on the battleship HMS Prince of Wales on the deck there where they sing the hymn. Later Churchill will choose it to be sung at his own funeral. It's in fact the final hymn at that service, sung as the great man's coffin is carried out of St. Paul's Cathedral. But I wonder what people think of, what's in their minds when they sing those opening lines in those remembrance ceremonies, or what was in our minds as we sang them just now. Our God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. What kind of help? What sort of hope? In wartime or in other conflict situations like some of you have known, some of you have come from conflicts yourselves, it's easy to think of the help you need. You want to survive. You want to get through the war or the battle unscathed. You want to live to see a brighter day. That's what you want. That's the hope that you have. And no doubt that's often the way it's been sung over the years. But what are we hoping for when we sing it now? In the last few days, we've had this massive shock to the system with Donald Trump's election as US president. A lot of people are very worried, very fearful about what that will mean, what will happen on the world stage as his presidency gets underway in January. What will it mean? Whatever we think about that, in an uncertain world, we do need help from somewhere. We do need some hope. But what is the help? And where? Thanks, Catherine. What is the help that we need? And where is the hope? The hymn is addressed to God. But what kind of help and hope can we expect from him anyway? Isaac Watts certainly knew what he meant by those lines, because he based the hymn on the words of Psalm 90 in the Bible, which we read a few minutes ago. So turn back to Psalm 90, page 599 of the Blue Bibles, and let's have a look. These psalms are the songbook of old Israel, assembled over many years for the people to sing, to celebrate, to call out to their God in time of needs. In all kinds of circumstances, in fact. This particular psalm, number 90, is probably the oldest of them all because its heading tells us that it is a prayer of Moses, the man of God. And in fact, that rings true because its lines echo words of his that are recorded in the early books of the Bible, which tell his story. Moses is the man who led Israel out of slavery in Egypt and brought them through the desert to the edge of the promised land. The event we call the Exodus that took place about 1500 years before Christ. And if we look into his words here, we'll find that the hope expressed in our hymn is not just pious words set to a stirring tune to make us feel better. No, this is solid reality. Here there is hope for us that will hold firm even in the face of death, whatever kind of death we will each eventually have to face. The psalm is based around two contrasts, two pairs of opposites. And that's what we'll look at now. Here's the first of those contrasts, eternity and a moment. And the contrast here is between God, who is eternal, and us, who are here today and gone tomorrow. Listen again to some of the opening words of the psalm. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. We think of the world as a permanent fixture, don't we? The mountains, think of the mountains that we know. Think of the Brecon Beacons, the mountains nearest to here. Somewhere that many of us have been to. We've hiked there. We know the feeling of the ground under our feet. As you've climbed those hills, or as you've gone further afield to the Alps, or somewhere like that, you won't have been thinking, this ground under my feet is going to disappear, or it's just appeared now. We think those mountains are permanent, but not so. God was around long before those mountains, and he'll be here long after they've gone, because he made them. The solid fact is that God is the creator and he is eternal. He goes back to infinity past and he extends to infinity future. Look at this on God's time scales. 1,000 years are like a day. And that's not intended as a precise equation, as some people have read it, because the next line says 1,000 years to God are like a watch in the night, that is either 3 or 4 hours, depending on what system you're using. To a sentry who's standing on guard duty during the night, his time on watch might feel like a long stretch, but in the grand scheme of things, it's nothing. 1,000 years to God is like that, a fleeting moment to the one who created time itself. To God, who in fact stands outside time and sees all its moments together in a single glance. Eternity is beyond our understanding. We can't get our heads around it, at least not in this life. God himself is beyond our understanding. From everlasting you are God to endless years the same, we sang. And us? How different we are. Look at these verses 3. You turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals. Verse 5, yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. Dust to dust, say the words of the old funeral service. In the story of creation, man is made from the dust of the ground. It's a way of saying that our bodies are made of ordinary stuff, the elements that are found in the earth itself. And to dust we return at the end of life. It's literally true. Go back to dust. And it happens so quickly. See how it's pictured here? The sleep of death. Another possible translation says we are like a dream, scarcely even remembered. You wake up within a few minutes, you've forgotten. Dream's gone. We're like new grass, the new grass of a Middle Eastern country that springs up fresh with the morning dew, and then by evening it's scorched and withered and dry. It's not a very glorious picture compared with how we like to think of ourselves. A few blades of grass for the mower to cut. That's us. Death is on its way for us all. And we don't know when it will strike. A tram turns over in Croydon. 7 ordinary people on their way to work are killed without warning. And that's peacetime. What about wartime? Churchill and Roosevelt met on board HMS Prince of Wales. What happened to that very ship just 4 months later? That deck where they stood to sing those words. Sunk by enemy aircraft in the Pacific, with the loss of 327 lives. No one knows when death will come. You ready? For many, of course, our end won't come in an event that makes the headlines. It will be quiet, private. Hopefully, it will be peaceful. But death in a hospital bed or in our own beds at home is no less terminal. It's just as final. People today spend time and effort avoiding all thought of death and staving it off for as long as possible, making ourselves look young, We're uncomfortable discussing the subject. We will do all we can to distract ourselves. We won't take even a minute of silence to contemplate what must happen to us one day. The Bible, by contrast, is very honest and very straightforward about the reality of death. It repeatedly brings us face to face with death, and it does us a huge favor. There's no hiding here. There's no pretending. Death is real. It can come suddenly, or we might have warning that it's on its way, but there is no cheating death. It will come in the end, and we must know that, and we must be ready. We're creatures of a moment. So, eternity and a moment. Second contrast in the psalm is this, a curse and a hope. Look with me at verses 7-9 of the psalm. And prepare to be shocked. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. This is where we learn that God is not actually the distant, uninvolved old man that we sometimes like to think. There's a reason why human life is often short and always painful. There's a reason why God says here, return to dust. The original design for the human race did not include death. Wasn't on the original agenda. Death came into this world because the first human beings decided to reject God's rule and care. Adam and Eve chose not to believe that God was good. They rebelled against him. They sinned. And God declared the death sentence on them and on the whole human race. This is what God says to Adam in Genesis chapter 3 verse 19, right back at the start. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. And Psalm 90 is echoing those words, reminding us why it is that we must die. Sin is the problem, that we as a race are rebels against our Creator. What Adam and Eve did at the beginning, on the fourth page of a 1,200-page Bible, we all do. We all turn away from God. We all think we have the right to decide what is good for us, what is best for us, and what is not. We all grasp at being little gods ourselves. That is sin, and God is rightly angry with our sin. That's his wrath, and that is why we live short lives and die. We aren't talking about a kindly, indifferent old man in the sky. We're dealing with a fearsome judge who cannot be distracted or bribed. And that is not an easy, cool, or trendy picture of God. It is not one, perhaps, that people would like to hear if we spoke to them out on Stapleton Road or whatever street you live on. But it is the true picture of God as the Bible reveals him. And what we need to know is the truth, not what feels nice. And as these words tell us, even what we do in secret is clearly visible to him. When the day of judgment comes, even what we have done out of sight will be brought to light. And we'll have to answer for it. The day is coming. There'll be no way of avoiding it. We will be condemned to eternal death. And that sentence will be right. It will be fully deserved. When people are terrified of God, we sometimes think they're mentally ill, but maybe not. They're not deluded. They've glimpsed the truth. The real God is fearsome. Verse 9 makes the explicit connection between God's wrath against our sin and our short life. Death is a grim reality, and it's such an anticlimax. In the famous words of T.S. Eliot, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. It's true. 70 or 80 years is what we get, says verse 10. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. If you look around the world, that's still a pretty good score. Our modern medicine has raised it a little higher in the West. We may get beyond 80 years. My parents have both got far beyond 80, so maybe I will too. But those years still come with trouble and sorrow, whatever kind of life we lead. We fly away, and mostly we're soon forgotten. However we may dress it up, death is real. The Bible helps us to see that. It helps us by not pretending, by not being sentimental. And if death is something we push away because the thought is so uncomfortable, the fact of judgment makes us more uneasy still. We're offenders against God. Sin has brought a curse on the whole world that applies to every single one of us. It's a sin that poisons our relationships with each other, with hatred and resentment and bitterness and betrayal and harsh words. And we see that on a small scale in our families and at work, in every relationship that is strained or broken. Sin has been at work. The curse has been active. But it's also sin that on a larger scale sets one nation against another and produces wars that slaughter millions and devastate uncounted lives. It's sin that leads to Aleppo. It's sin that leads to the work of Islamic State and Boko Haram. Moses, as he writes, knows that we need to think about this and we need to respond. These words ought to banish our fanciful notions and our wishful thinking about God and the afterlife. Verse 11, if only we knew the power of your anger. Your wrath is as great as the fear that is your due. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. If we're wise, we will recognize where we stand with God. We will see that he stands against us in our sinfulness. We will grasp that he is vast and we are tiny. Our days are few, and we will use those days to seek God. The great news, of course, is that the psalm doesn't end there. There is a hope. After all, it began with this in verse 1. Lord, you've been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Now that doesn't sound unhopeful. God doesn't sound like an enemy there. Why? Because beyond the curse, there is a hope. The psalm moves on to prayer, verse 13. Relent, Lord, how long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. God has said, return to dust. Here, literally, we have God, Lord, you return. Relent, turn back. Have compassion on us. We need your help here. We see that. And clearly from what follows next, there's a real hope that God will answer. Verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. Moses knows what he's asking for. He can imagine having God, not as an enemy, but somehow as a loving friend, a benevolent friend. He can picture getting up in the morning and facing the day, not with guilty dread, but with satisfaction, because he knows that he is loved by the God of all the earth. To be satisfied in the love of God, that's what he's praying for. To be glad instead of terrified. And he seems to think that God will give him what he asks. Moses prays that God's actions will be seen. Verse 16, may your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. Moses himself has seen the Exodus, those great and fearful events when God sent the 10 plagues against Egypt, destroyed that enemy country and many of its people. He has seen how God miraculously brought the nation of Israel out of Egypt, opened a way through the Red Sea for them to pass, and then drowned the pursuing army as the water came back. He's seen it. He'd seen the appearance of God at Mount Sinai, where the mountain was covered in fire and cloud and smoke, and he's been up the mountain to speak one-to-one with God himself. Unimaginable what that was like, Sinai. He's seen God's work in power to save and take care of his people. He's been there. When Moses speaks about God's deeds being shown, that's what he has in mind. That's the splendor of God he wants their children to see. Good news is, we've seen something even better than that. We've seen God's greatest deeds. What's the greatest thing God has ever done to rescue people? Open up a road through the sea? Better than that. Overthrow an enemy army? Better still. God's greatest ever rescue was to have his son, Jesus Christ, executed on a wooden cross. Executed by exactly the same kind of people that he was coming to save. The cross is a much bigger and better rescue than digging the Israelites out of Egypt, which Moses saw. It's a much bigger battle than any of the battles in our national history, even the most terrible of them. Because when he went willingly to die on the cross, Jesus Christ defeated the power of sin. He fought and won the great war. He did that by taking judgment and condemnation and God's wrath in place of us. He faced the terror of death. He took the penalty we deserved, even though he was completely innocent himself. The greatest rescue plan in history. A Christian is someone who has seen that they're a sinner, an offender in the sight of God, who's recognized what that means, that we face judgment from God because of our sin, who's then seen Jesus Christ crucified, God's rescue plan for helpless people, and trusted Jesus to forgive, to take that condemnation away and to put them right with God. God is a stern and uncompromising judge. He is the awesome God of eternity, but he's also the God of love. And he's created this way of escape for us. It costs the agony and death of his beloved son, who's God himself. But God decided that it was worth it. It was worth the sacrifice. It was worth the cost and the pain. It was worth what it cost him because he wanted to have this relationship with us. He wanted to have our relationship healed and to bring us home to him. And so he did. We make no contribution to this plan. There's nothing at all we can contribute. In this particular peace conference, we bring nothing at all to the table except the problem, our sin. God, on the other hand, brings everything. His justice, his love, his compassion, his power. Above all, he brings the death of his son, the Lord Jesus. We have nothing good to bring to the table, but there is something wonderful for us to take away. When we trust in Jesus Christ, we're forgiven. Our past is dealt with and we have a new beginning. A clean conscience. No more guilt to crush us. Our future is secure. Not eternal death, but eternal life. If you are a Christian, then you're forgiven through Jesus. Don't be plagued by guilt. He has said you are free, so be free. In fact, what we take away is the answer to the prayer in this psalm. The unfailing love of God to satisfy us, verse 14. There's nothing else in this life that will ultimately satisfy us, but he will. Joy and gladness. Yes, now we really have something to sing about, because this hope will never disappoint us. There's hope for our kids, verse 16. Don't we worry about our children growing up in this broken and troubled world? I've been there, I know. But they can have the same hope we now have. They can know God. They can know Jesus Christ, and he will see them all the way through this life, through death, and into eternity. And because our lives are no longer pointless, our work is not pointless either. Verse 17, may the favor of the Lord our God rest on us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Knowing Jesus Christ, life means something. It's going somewhere good. He gives value to our work here and now. Whatever kind of work we're doing, however pointless it might sometimes seem from Monday to Friday. No, it's not meaningless. Because we do it for Christ and we do it with him. We're working to serve him. And meanwhile, he is working in this life to make us like him and get us ready for the next life. God has been our help in ages past. He has rescued our nation from many dangers. We need to cultivate the memories of those days so that we do not forget. Thanks to God and the sacrifice of many lives, we have freedom in this land. And we should always be grateful for that because it means so much and pledge to defend it. If you've come here from somewhere less peaceful and more troubled, which many of you have, we welcome you here. We're glad you're here. We want you to be at home here. And there's a lot that is wrong with Britain, but this is one great blessing we have to enjoy and to share. We live in peace and we're thankful. But here is something far better even than that. God also offers each of us an eternal land, an eternal home, a dwelling place for eternity. Our God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, be our defense while life shall last, and our eternal home.